Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain. As part of our continuing focus on solutions, today we will talk about achieving women's equality. Women have made considerable progress since the modern women's movement in the 1960s. Women are reaching top levels in government, business, and society, and it's become much more acceptable to have women in leadership positions. Nancy Pelosi became the first female Speaker of the House. Hillary Clinton became a U.S. Senator, Secretary of State, and next year may be our first woman president. Sheryl Sandberg of Facebook is one of a number of women leaders in business. Despite these advances, women are still a long way from equality. The U.S. Congress is still over 80% male. In fact, the number of women in political office has plateaued for about the past 20 years. Likewise, women still make up only about 4% of CEOs at big companies. Although we think of the U.S. as a world leader for women's rights, in fact, a global gender gap report shows the U.S. ranking 20th in the world. Why are we still so far from gender equality in the U.S., and what can we do about it? We will have two of the top leaders in the women's movement help us answer these pressing questions today. First, Eleanor Smeal, president of the Feminist Majority, and then Terry O'Neill, president of the National Organization for Women. Our first guest, Eleanor Smeal, has led efforts for the economic, political, and social equality and empowerment of women worldwide for over three decades. One of the architects of the modern drive for women's equality, Ms. Smeal is highly respected as a political analyst, strategist, and grassroots organizer. She has played a pivotal role in defining the debate, developing the strategies, and charting the direction of the modern women's movement. Eleanor Smeal, welcome to All Together Now.
Good talking to you, Eleanor.
Yeah, you know, I admire so much the great work that you've done in your life, and you've been at this for decades. So I'm wondering, what has motivated you to dedicate your life to improving conditions for women?
Well, what drives me is there's tremendous injustice and inequalities towards women right here in the United States, but certainly worldwide, and in some areas it's just beyond belief what's happened to women. I mean, we are still, some places, the last to eat. We're unfortunately denied in many different locales really a chance to get education. And even here in the United States, as you know, we're grossly underrepresented in elected political office. We're 20%, but we're also very small numbers on corporate boards and other places of decision making. So, and it affects the bottom line. I mean, women in our own country make less than men for the same work, but more, it just is important. Our work is frequently not recognized. So in Social Security, for example, if you take off time to either raise a child or to take care of a sick elderly parent, that gets a zero in your Social Security. And you only can, deduct five zeros, and basically it brings down, you know, what you can earn in Social Security when you retire. I only mention that because there's not a system that doesn't sort of discriminate against us. And I've been saying for years, if you put in fringe benefits into the comparison of what men get and what women get, it would be a much larger gap, because women are jobs or frequently do not have health insurance coverage, and not one pay, something like half of the female population does not have one day of paid sick leave that in the workforce.
Wow, that's scary.
Yep.
So
we're lagging behind and many of the social benefits, but you know and I know that we really don't even have constitutional equality. We are still laboring under the fact that when the Constitution was written, women not only didn't have the vote, we did not have equality, especially once we got married, You know, we had to fight for married property rights for women. That came at the end of the 19th century. However, we keep on correcting a horrible mistake which was made that we didn't have full rights, and we still don't have them.
Right. And you have been a major architect and leader for the women's movement, and we have had some amazing gains over the past, really, 50 years. What would you say are the major achievements of the modern women's movement, and what were the effective strategies that we used to get to where we are now?
One of the biggest gains was in the area of education. When I went to school, something like only 12% of American women had a college education, and we were about, and not the majority, but the minority of students at the college level. Right now, we're the majority of students at the college level, and as you know, we are now probably about half of the medical doctors and medical students, law students, et cetera. When I can remember my early speeches in like 1970, where we would say women were 3% of the medical of the law students and 8% of the medical students. So Title IX was a big step forward because it said that essentially in any federally funded educational program, you could not practice sex discrimination. It prohibited sex discrimination. Well, most higher education has federal funding. So we fought for its passage, and then the Reagan administration came along and gutted it in a decision. They argued for that we had to trace the dollars, and only that program that received the dollars could be non-discriminatory. In other words, we'd have to prove that in this science building they had a grant from the federal government, so in that building they couldn't practice discrimination. It was that. Anyway, we then went back and restored it, and it took us 4 years, but we passed the Civil Rights Restoration Act, and we restored the original power of Title IX. But even having said that, we still don't have full equal educational opportunity, but it was a giant step forward, and I still think one of our major accomplishments. But we also have fought, you know, for equal pay and to enforce Title VII. We're not there. We've closed the gap somewhat, but I think that we have to tackle the benefits issue. And it's going to be a real struggle, but we need to have paid family medical leave. We have now unpaid family medical leave. That was an advance because you used to be able to fire somebody. When I first started, we were fighting cases of discrimination against pregnant school teachers, that when they were a certain size, the pregnancy was showing, they could be fired. Well, that's not the case, obviously. There's and basically, we now, in the 80s, won unpaid family medical leave, meaning that if you took time off to take care of a newborn or to you yourself were sick or you helped a sick spouse or an elderly parent, that you can't be fired. You can't lose your seniority and all those kinds of questions. But it isn't paid, and we're one of the few countries in the world, I think there's only two left, that don't have paid family medical leave, of the industrialized, more modern countries. So that's the next step in it, but at least, we did break through on some of the most gross discrimination cases. When we started, women were not allowed to have bylines in magazines. They were the researchers. It didn't matter if they graduated from one of the best colleges in the country or what. They weren't allowed to be reporters. Now, of course, we can, but even having said we can have bylines, if you look at discrimination, women still don't have as many bylines in some prestigious publications as men. So it's an ongoing fight, but we have definitely made progress. I wish I could say to you right now, though, that we have completely won. By the way, one of the biggest advances just occurred. The Affordable Care Act prohibits sex discrimination and health insurance pricing. And before that act, women were charged in individual policies as much as a couple hundred percent more than men. In other words, almost double, either one and a half to double the times of what a man paid for lesser benefits, because you could exclude maternity from the benefit list. Now you can't exclude maternity, and in fact, you can't have just pricing based on sex, and most importantly, health insurance has to cover things like birth control, which they formerly did not necessarily cover.
That's an impressive array of achievements there, and I know you've been involved in every one of those struggles for women's equality, so I thank you for that. And I'm a personal beneficiary because I was in one of the first women to go to Yale, and the time I went to Yale, I think we had 20 men to one woman. Mm-hmm. So I often was the only woman in the class, and it is an odd feeling where you feel like you're supposed to be speaking for your whole gender. But it's, I've been back to the campus lately, and it's now 50-50. It's much more even. It just feels completely different. And as we know, having a good education is just a doorway to pretty much everything else you want to do in your life. So I salute you for all your great work there.
It took a team effort. A lot of people worked on these things. And we have to remember, though, if we didn't have a handful of women in Congress, remember it was sponsored by Title IX by Edith Green and Patsy Mink. And Patsy Mink herself, who was the congresswoman from Hawaii, had always wanted to be a doctor. And she applied to medical school and was accepted. And when she got there, they said, oh, wait, you're not a boy, you're a girl. And so it was taken from her. And she never forgot it. She actually then decided to go to law school to fight discrimination. So I was very lucky to have known Patsy and worked with her on many things. And basically, it's those women. And Martha Griffiths, who was the congresswoman from Michigan, made sure that sex was covered in Title VII, which prohibits discrimination in employment. It was initially it was going to be race. We got the word sex added. Not me. In that case, it predates me. But still, it's important that key women were at the table. There weren't enough of them, but those few that were there in the 60s and 70s made a very big difference.
Yes, I think that's right. And then we look at someone like U.S. Senator Barbara Boxer, who talks about when she was first coming along that it wasn't legal for women to get a mortgage or a credit card in their own name. It had to be through their husband or their father. And you just look in one lifespan how far we've come in some of those areas. And
yeah,
we definitely need...
The Equal Credit Act was passed in 1975. It was a drive of a NALC committee, National Organization for Women's Committee. But frankly, the mortgage thing wasn't solved until later. And I still think a woman should be very careful that her name is on the mortgage as well as her spouse's.
Right. As want to make sure that the woman has equal ownership of the property there.
Well, you know, when I was president of NOW, and I bought a house, and this was Virginia, and it was my then husband's name, Charles, and it had et ux, and I said, "What's et ux?" And that meant, and I guess in Latin, and wife. And I insisted, but I don't even remember how that ended because I knew I wouldn't. That wasn't going to be a problem in my particular marriage. But the fact that was still there in about 1980 or in the early 80s is just shows you these things are not that far in the past.
Right, it's within living memory here. So a lot of good and important changes come. And you talked about Patsy Mink and Congress fighting discrimination, and you look at, so often getting women into government has been key to helping us get our other achievements. You know, in the early women's movement in the 19th century, they put their women's right to vote as a top priority, thinking if we can get women the right to vote, have influence politically, we can make progress in the other spheres. And they were exactly right strategically.
Right. And I believe if we were half the members of Congress today, probably not even half we would need, 40%, family planning and abortion would no longer be a political issue. I really feel that it's disgraceful, really, that you have legislatures where we're less than 20%, and they're deciding the health care for females and making exceptions for our health care, which would not be for men's. I mean, why did we have to fight for birth control coverage when Viagra was covered? Why do you see Viagra on ads on television and you hardly see an ad on birth control? I mean, essentially, decisions have been made by either executives or Congress people or state legislatures that impact females' reproductivity. But for heaven's sakes, for men, there's no exceptions.
Right, and we still see, even today, some of these congressional panels with the members of Congress where it's all men and they're grilling women who are testifying. It's just shocking in 2015 we're still there. So, and it felt to me, I graduated from college in the 1970s, and it felt like we were making steady progress, and we were kind of on a steady march to equality, breaking the glass ceiling in different areas, having women astronauts and women on the Supreme Court and more women in Congress. But actually, we seem to have plateaued getting women into government at about 20% and kind of been hanging around that level for about 20 years. What do you think has capped our progress there, and what do we need to do to break through to get to at least that 40% of women legislators?
Well, I personally think that we have to change some rules, because right now it is very hard for women to get a primary where they don't have huge amounts of challenges, just even in the primary. The field doesn't get cleared as much, because both parties at one level or another have problems on ending sex discrimination. Although I will say, and this is not a partisan comment, it's just reality, the Democrats have made far more progress. And as you know, the Democratic leader in the United States Congress at the House side is a outspoken and strong feminist. So there has been definitely more progress. But I think we have to recognize that the things that we want to have equality have opposition from business. And I know it's not important, what business? Major corporations. Because basically, for example, I mentioned that we now have pricing and health insurance cannot be based on sex, nor can benefits be based, on sex, that they can't charge us more and give us less. Well, we have a pension system that discriminates on the basis of sex, not just Social Security, in my opinion, but also private pensions and annuities. Life insurance has different pricing based on sex. Auto insurance has had it. I could go on. So it's okay still to discriminate on the basis of sex on very big money things. But just think about, we keep hearing about equal pay for equal work. I like to say equal pay for work of comparable value, because we still have a sex-segregated workforce in which over 90% of the nurses are women, for example. But let's just go, what would happen is the cost of the payroll would go up. Right now, they can pay less for an adult person who is just as educated, frankly, in many cases, more educated than their counterpart male, and yet they have an excuse for paying us less because they have pegged these jobs as being paid less. And so we have opposition from those corporate interests that employ mostly women. And basically, I could go on like that, or even public policy. I mean, look at the attack on teachers in elementary and secondary schools by right-wingers. Well, teachers are principally a female job at the elementary and secondary level, and they want to pay it less. And of course, women are now the breadwinner or a significant breadwinner in households all over the country. 40% of American women are single. Either they're divorced, widowed, never married, separated, whatever, but they're the sole support. So basically, there's a money factor here. And as long as they can throw the issue into a sexist round, somehow pit men against women, they think they make money. But I think more and more men and women are catching on to the fact this is dollars and cents, this discrimination, and it has to stop. So we're gaining support among men, and we're also gaining support among women, and are a significant, you know, now majority among women, and a large portion of men are saying, wait a minute, all I'm doing by her getting less is our household gets less.
Yeah, it's great to see some of the men picking up being feminists. Like they say, you know, not every woman is a feminist and not every feminist is a woman. It's great to see the men stepping up and speaking out about women's equality.
Right.
I recently participated at a women's conference in Iceland about a week ago, celebrating 100 years of women's right to vote, and learned that Iceland ranks number one in the world for gender equality. And I have to say, it just felt so amazing being in a country where they have, not only do they have paid leave, they have 9 months of paid family leave. They have affordable quality child care. They have 40% of women in parliament and in the national cabinet. And they even have a person whose job is to do gender budgeting in the federal government.
We've been advocating that there be a gender impact statement with the budget. I think it originated in South Africa and Australia. Iceland certainly has it. Other countries do, too. And if you see... you pass a budget item, and it tells you its impact on men, its impact on women, boys and girls. You become conscious to the fact that, wait a minute, this is unequal. Let's figure this out. And we've been advocating that. By the way, one of the reasons Iceland moved ahead is, I think it was in the 70s, they had a strike. It's a very small country, and so in population. And so 20,000 people... women walked off the jobs, and that started a whole dialogue on the importance of women working.
Yeah, that was impressive, and they were saying to me they tried not to call it a strike, they just were taking a day off, but all the women did it all at once, and it made clear to themselves and everybody else that nothing in the country would move if the women weren't participating. So that was a big plus, and then they elected the first woman president elected by the people in anywhere in the world, President Vigdis, in 1980. Yep. And, you know, having her as a role model was great. And then the women were saying that they, as a voting bloc, decided to make access to affordable quality child care a key issue, and you would not get elected to a position in Iceland unless you supported affordable quality child care. And so once they had the child care, then that freed up the women to participate more in the civic life and to do other things. And so it's just been amazing to see, but it's inspiring to me to know that everything we're asking for is very reasonable and it can be done, and in fact it's already being done. Eleanor Roosevelt said, if it exists, it's possible.
That's exactly. But also, a new thing has happened, which I think is quite encouraging. Many economists, the United Nations for an institution, many institutions have recognized one fundamental fact, that if women's economy, if women are paid more, if women's resources and intellect is used more, the country moves higher on the economic scale. In other words, to eliminate poverty, to eliminate especially extreme poverty, but even poverty, you have to pay women more. You know, we have, I hear over and over again, conservatives and right-wingers say we have to get, you know, cut back welfare and all this. And, well, they wouldn't need welfare if women got paid what they would deserve. I mean, if we didn't have such gross discrimination. So basically, it helps the whole economy if women are paid decently and they're up and they have opportunities and they are treated as full and equal adult citizens. That country advances. The worse the women are treated, the more impoverished the country.
Right, that's so true. And what do you think now? You know, it makes so much sense to have women's equality from a fairness point of view, from eliminating poverty point of view, from drawing on the intelligence and talent and ideas of half of our population. So, you know, why don't we have gender equality yet? What do you see as our biggest obstacles now to having women's equality in the U.S., and what can we do about it?
Well, I think that right now we have two major problems. We are still very, very underrepresented. We have a gerrymandered system that continues the underrepresentation. And so basically we're going to have to, I personally think if we went to multi-member districts, we'd increase the participation or the election chances of both women and minorities. But right now we have artificial gerrymandering that keeps ethnic groups, racial groups, and women underrepresented. And we have to have strategies to break that and understand it. When you look at the number of women in office, we can't internalize and say it's our fault. There was a systematic sex discrimination and race discrimination going on, and we are still fighting to overcome it. So that's one thing. The other thing, frankly, is we got to fight for more money. This whole thing, because you know, money's power in this country. It is anywhere. And raising the minimum wage to $15 is helping women's rights. The average person on the minimum wage is a female. That is a very gendered issue and a race issue because the women of color are most likely to be taken advantage of. So we have to realize when we're fighting for work of comparable value, equal pay for work of comparable value, we are fighting for our kids. We're fighting for the future of our country. If they cannot continue to balance the budgets, either corporations or the government, on the backs of women. Right now we have a taxation system that takes more out. You keep hearing that, you know, the boss is paying less percentage-wise than the secretary. That's simply because the withholding tax is capped at 120,000 right now. But that means people who make more of it, they no longer withhold from their pay for Social Security or Medicare. Well, Medicare is on the whole sum, but on Social Security. So it's all of these, you know, ways in which there is a good reason that we're lagging behind in pay. We have to fix them, and we have to say that these are not only, they're women's issues, they're families' issues, they're justice issues, and frankly, we have to demand they're no longer going to balance it on our backs. And understand, like, one of the things that was very interesting to me, when Obama came in, he said something about we got to have shovel-ready jobs. The women's movement, we all, and I'm very proud I helped coordinate it as well as did NOW and some other groups, we got all together. I mean, it wasn't just some. It was the National Association of Social Workers, teachers groups, the American Association of University Women, I could go on, a huge list of us. And we met immediately with the transition team and said, wait a minute, this shovel-ready stuff, we want to make sure that you have on that list the teachers have to be paid and social workers have to be part of it, and women's jobs are considered if we're going to get women, you know, the country back to work again after the Great Recession. And it worked. We kept our eye on the prize, and I think we have got to keep our eyes on how programs affect the dollar and the bottom line for women.
Right, exactly right. And, you know, you talk about not balancing the budget on the back of the women. You know, the argument biggest against increasing the minimum wage to $15 or at least higher than what it is now is that it's going to put companies out of business. But study after study shows that, in fact, whenever they have had increases in minimum wage, it really has not had that effect.
Well, just but, reverse. Know, it's helped to fuel the economy. I mean, old man Ford, the first Ford, knew that if he was going to sell cars, he had to pay the workers a decent amount so they could buy the cars. So actually, the more you give to the lower end of the economic scale, workers at the law, the more you circulate money. It multiplies. It creates growth. And we should be using these kinds of issues. And by the way, we shouldn't forget the older woman. And basically, we now have a Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, who introduced the Ryan budget, which privatized wants to privatize Social Security and voucherize. Just gave me a voucher, so much a year for Medicare and get rid of Medicaid. And how they make older people think, oh, it's not going to affect me, is they grandfather in the current beneficiaries. But, hey, the next group of older women will be absolutely taken advantage of. And so we cannot let that happen. This is a very big worry to me. And bottom line, again, is that if you have dependent older women, they will lose their freedom. And so it's not going to happen only to, you know, to the people that are currently getting it. The next group should not have to have that happen to them. And I think that the fight for Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security have got to be taken on by the women's movement, recognizing that the bulk of people who will be very badly hurt will be women.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think we've got a looming retirement crisis here. As, you know, women have been paid less. They've been working more. You know, working fewer years because of raising children or taking care of family members, and you know, living
longer
than men.
And the jobs that they're in tend to have fewer pension benefits. So,
right.
A huge portion of the women only live on Social Security, and some of these right wingers think, "Oh, that's okay. Grandma can go move in with the kids." Well, come on. The great independence of women, you know, we love our kids, we love our grandchildren, but, you know, at certain ages, you got to have some, you're an adult, you've earned your benefits, you've earned the chance to make your own decisions. And so I do think that's going to, frankly, I think it is a third world politics. They pulled that back, but they keep mentioning it. They keep mentioning that the system is broke. Don't worry, y'all, that are on it right now. But our kids, what do you mean? We have to have a guaranteed Social Security program. We can't depend on a stock market that can crash and clean the tables and you happen to turn 65 that year.
Right. No, exactly. We've got to defend or expand Social Security and Medicare. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And one last question here is, you are the person who identified the gender gap in elections, and I'm curious, how did you notice it, and how did the gender gap affect the election of President Obama, and what do you think its relevance is for the upcoming 2016 election?
I started studying women's political behavior when I was in graduate school. It irritated me because there was a book out at that time saying Political Man, and they actually made the assertion that women only voted as men's pocketbook and were not interested in politics. And I knew that I was interested in politics. I didn't believe that statement. There was no studies to show it. And so I became a student of polling. And I always believed and knew because I did it's too long a thing, but I actually did a study on this, and it actually was published on this in the 70s. But basically, by 1980, I was confident that we knew there was a gender gap on issues. We knew that women support Social Security more than men. It supports all the social programs because they understand its importance to their lives. And were more reluctant to send troops overseas. I could say all these different factors and what the percentage different was. And there were studies showing that women really voted more on issues than men did. But we didn't have anything definitive. I happened to have been at that time very close to Lou Harris, who was the dean of polling. And I asked him, would he start showing polling results by sex? In other words, how much, you know, what percentage of women were for Reagan versus what percentage of for men? He said, and I said, it's my thought that there is a gender gap in most of these races. And he said, oh, yeah, sure. He said, yeah, I never thought of separating it. Anyway, he started to show it. And one of the reasons we wanted to show it was the Equal Rights Amendment. We knew that, for example, Reagan was for the E and the R, but not the A. And he was, you know, he had turned in his later life against abortion choice, et cetera.
Well, you mean he was for equality for women but didn't want the amendment to the Constitution?
Yeah, that's right. He was for the equal rights but not the amendment. He and they were fighting affirmative action for women. And anyway, sure enough, there was an 8-point gender gap. 8 points is a lot.
That's big.
And when you're talking about half the population. And everybody made fun of us when we pointed it out, saying, well, he still won. And we said, yeah, he won this time. We will guarantee you that women's votes will eventually elect the President of the United States. I actually wrote a book titled that, and it was entitled exactly that, but it was similar. And but basically, by 1982, sooner than we thought, for example, Governor Cuomo, the first Governor Cuomo, was elected because a majority of women voted for him, a majority of men voted for this opponent. And we started to trace it election after election. I did a huge number of interviews on it. I was president now. We did. Eventually, we were no longer laughed at. People did. Pollsters had to admit there was a difference. And President Obama was elected with a majority of women's votes. That gender gap was very key. It's been key. And so, basically, we cannot understate the power of women's votes. We don't vote as men's pocketbooks. We vote on our own pocketbooks. We vote on our own interests. We are independent human adults. In addition, I now believe that the feminist factor in the woman's vote is helping to push the gender gap. By that I mean women who self-identify as feminists are more likely to push that difference in demand for the issues, as well as men who self-identify as feminists, and that number for both men and women is significant.
That's great. Well, that's all the time we have, and if people, our listeners, want to learn more, you can go to feministmajority.org. Ellie Smale, thank you.
Also feminist.org. We have feministmajority.org, which is our C4. Which are Action Fund. We have feminist.org, and we also own msmagazine.com.
Fabulous. Ellie Smale, thank you for being on the show and for all your important work.
Thank you. Thank you.
Our next guest is Terry O'Neill, president of the National Organization for Women, the largest organization of feminist activists in the United States, with hundreds of thousands of contributing members and more than 500 affiliates in all 50 states and the District of Columbia. Ms. O'Neill is also a feminist attorney and former professor of law. Her feminist activism began in the 1990s, fighting right-wing extremists in the Deep South, including David Duke. Terry O'Neill, welcome to All Together Now.
Hi, Eleanor. How are you? It's great to hear your voice.
I'm great. I'm happy you're on the show here. And, you know, when I saw you last week at the National Press Club, you were speaking about the economic security that so many women face now. And Ellie Smale was just on talking about this kind of looming retirement crisis. So what concerns you about women's economic situation?
Well, you know, it's for so many women, every time they turn around, they just really can't catch a break, right? So two-thirds of minimum wage workers in the United States, two-thirds of those workers are women. And it gets worse. 70% of tipped workers in the United States are women. The tipped workers, the federal minimum wage for tipped workers is just $2.13 an hour. The excuse for having tipped workers have such a low minimum wage is that, well, they live off their tips. Well, actually, the vast majority of women who wait tables and get tipped income, the vast majority of them are not working at the fanciest restaurants. Those waiters are actually usually men. Where the women usually work is at the IHOP or the Olive Garden or the TGI Friday. And at $2.13 minimum wage, if you include their tips, they frequently are getting a gross income of about $5 or $6 an hour. So that's one piece. So we've got a system that actually clusters women into these lower paid jobs. You look at STEM, that's the science, technology, engineering, and math professions, very predominantly male. And that's where the salaries tend to be higher, but that is not where the women are. The other places where women predominate in the workplace would be in sort of caregiving roles. So child care, health care, elder care, also social workers, also elementary school teachers. But as you go up the ladder in the school system to middle school and high school and college and graduate school, you find women, fewer and fewer women, percentage-wise, as it goes up the ladder, and fewer women as it goes up the pay scale. So in all of these ways, women in the workforce, there's partly flat-out sex discrimination with an employer specifically paying a woman less than a man for doing substantially the same work. What happened to Lilly Ledbetter? But beyond that, it's this clustering of women in the lower paid occupations that make it really difficult for women. So you take that piece, and then you overlay race on top of it. Overall, women of all races are paid about 77 or 78 cents to the dollar paid to white men. But when you break it down by race, what you find is that African-American women are being paid just 64 cents to the dollar, and Latinas are being paid just 54 cents. That's 54 cents to the dollar. Okay. So on that kind of ratio, how is a woman going to save up money for the things that she needs to save for? A down payment on a house, her children's college education, her own retirement. She's not. Okay. And it gets worse yet one more time. I'm sorry to be taken
up. Not a pretty picture.
But then you overlay the added expenditures that women have compared with men. Women are far more likely than men to be the primary caregivers and the sole custodian of children, but also the primary financial support for those very children. Women are also disproportionately.
Wait a minute, you're saying women are more likely than men to be the primary breadwinner?
Not the primary breadwinner in their household, but when it comes to caring for children, divorced women are much more likely to be the custodial parent, and the custodial parent bears the brunt, the largest share of the financial responsibility for children.
Right. Gotcha.
Right? So in that sense, now already in 40% of households, women are the primary breadwinner. In 40% of households in the U.S., women are the primary breadwinner. So you look at those households, and you know that those households are struggling dramatically because those women are not being paid adequately. But in addition to not being paid adequately, they are coming out of pocket. I mentioned that two-thirds of minimum wage workers are women. They don't have health care associated with their jobs. That's the nature of a minimum wage job. So they have to come out of pocket for their own health care expenses. They have to come out of pocket for their children's health care expenses. Every time you turn around, a woman worker does not have what is referred to as the wealth escalator that male workers more often have. Male workers are 50% more likely to have a pension attached to their jobs, and not enough pensions going to men these days, but women are even less likely. to have a pension or even a 401k. So less money coming in the door, more money going out the door, and now you can see why this looming retirement crisis is so frightening to so many women.
Yeah, because, you know, you think about it, you put all these pieces together. Women are in lower income occupations, so they're getting paid less. They're not getting the benefits that men get. As you mentioned, if they have health care, it's because they're paying for it themselves out of pocket. They don't have a pension to help with the retirement. They're taking time out to have children or to take care of children or other family members. And they're living longer than men. So by the time you add a lifetime of gender discrimination in the workforce up, you know, women are looking at longer lifetimes with less money to be able to draw on from their Social Security.
That's exactly right. And, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine the other day, and it occurred to me as I'm complaining about all of this. And there was something about, well, you know, something came up, and it suddenly struck me. Yeah, back in the 1950s, people used to say, well, gee, women don't have to be paid as much as men, because what does she have to spend her money on? The little lady doesn't really need that much money.
Right, I remember it was called pin money.
Pin money. And here we are in the 21st century, and we are living a reality as if women didn't need any more than that. But in fact, we know they do. They support their families.
Right. No, exactly. And I remember my sister in one of her first jobs in a travel agency talking about she was doing the same job as a man, but he was getting paid a lot more because he had a wife and children, and she was single because she chose to be single and remains so to this day. But he was getting paid more for the whole, for doing the same work. And it just, you know, it's a matter of unfairness just on it, on the surface of it. But now you add on the fact that so many women are the primary breadwinner in their families and responsible for raising the children. So they have to earn the money to take care of the children, and they're still not getting the pay.
That's right. And the entire household is suffering as a result of it, entire families. So as women have moved more into the workforce and have become much more of an integral part of the family's, you know, total financial picture, of the household's total financial picture, that has been happening, unfortunately, right at the same time in history that middle class wages have flattened out or been pushed down. And frankly, it's not an accident that middle class wages have flattened out and gone down. It's actually the result of laws and policies enacted in the United States Congress and in state legislatures that make it much easier for companies to bust unions, make it much harder for employees to form unions and to bargain collectively to push their wages and benefits up. So now you have underpaid people, namely women, being either the sole or a primary financial provider for their families, and at the same time, both men and women's salaries flattening out. And you can see how this has huge implications for the vast majority of people in the country. And this retirement crisis is really facing men as well as women. And we absolutely know what to do about it. We know what can be done about it. The only problem that we have is that our elected officials are so busy promoting a corporate agenda and frankly being elected by the Koch brothers bank that it's very difficult to get these policies passed that we know could fix the retirement crisis.
So let's unpack this a little bit, because you know that there's a lot in what you're saying. The first is, clearly, it seems to me, with this retirement income crisis, we are facing a train wreck as a country. It's, you know, predominantly women, but also men are just not going to have enough money to have anything near what they need to live in dignity in their golden years. So, you know, this looks like a train wreck. Now you're saying we know what to do about it. So tell us, what can we do about it? What should we be doing that we're not now?
So the foundation of fixing the retirement crisis is actually our Social Security system. And I want to talk about that in just a moment. But to back up, when FDR was the president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and pushed through the New Deal, a lot of the policies that he wanted to push through were really designed to help people in their retirement years. What they recognized as a result of the Great Depression was that people who were thrown out of work they really didn't have any cushion to fall back on. And when they got too old to work and had to retire, again, they had no savings to fall back on. So the Social Security system was a key part of it. But back in the 1930s, the Social Security system was just one of three pieces that people were expected to have so that they could live in dignity in their retirement years. So one of the pieces was a pension, and companies were being very much encouraged to provide pensions to their workers. A second piece was personal savings. So workers should have a high enough wage that they could set aside a little bit every month for their retirement years in their personal savings. And then the third piece was Social Security. So back in the day, Social Security was just one out of three big pieces of a retirement security package. Well, what has happened over the past 30 years is that pensions have begun to disappear. At one point, I believe it was in the 1960s, nearly 40% of workers, mostly male, but 40% of workers actually worked in jobs that provided pensions. Well, you work for so many years, maybe 5 years before you vest. But if you stay with that company for 5 years, you vest, and then you get a pension when you go to retire. And a pension is a monthly check, month after month after month, no matter how long you live. You live to be 95, you get that check. You live to be 75, a check stops when you're 75. There's a little something for surviving spouses and for surviving children, but basically it's gone when you die. So that's how a pension works. Nowadays, the pensions have all but dried up. There's just hardly any more jobs anymore that have real pensions attached to them. The other piece is personal savings, and of course, with flattening wages and skyrocketing costs of college for kids, middle-class families are finding that they're not putting away personal savings. So personal savings have become very, very difficult to come by. So what does that leave us with? Well, it leaves us with a Social Security system that has been stressed financially by a sort of the perfect storm, if you will, of less money coming into the system in the way of payroll taxes because the wages are flat and going down, right? Mm-hmm. So everybody pays 6.2% of their wages into the Social Security system. Oh, but if wages are not going up, then it's that much less money going into the system. That's one piece. Secondly, Social Security was designed so that your payroll tax is applied only up to $117,000 this year. It goes up every year for inflation, but so $117,000. Well, with galloping inequality, $117,000 is when you put that kind of a cap on the wages subject to the Social Security tax, you've got more and more people who are making $1 million a year or $500,000 a year or whatever, and their wages are not going into the system at all. So, again, you're restricting the resources available to the Social Security system. And then you have the geniuses on Wall Street who have figured out how to characterize a lot of the earnings that they make, and they are working hard for that money. They're putting in 60 and 70 and 80 hours a week working for this money, but they don't call it taxes, they call it carried interest, and none of that income goes into the Social Security system. So the first thing we need to do is to bring all the earnings into the Social Security system. Those rich guys, they got rich because our country has a system that helped make them rich, and, bless their hearts, that's good for them, but they don't get to pull their earnings out of our system. We helped make them rich. They're part of our country. They're part of our democracy. Their earnings have to be included in our system, and that would really shore up the system. The other thing we need to do is simply expand the benefits for everybody to take account of the fact that the pensions have dried up through no fault of the workers, that the personal savings have dried up, again, through no fault of the workers. We need to take account of that. So a larger Social Security system with a much more generous set of benefits is the first thing we have to do.
Yeah, you know, I like your proposal there about bringing all income into the Social Security system. You know, why should these Wall Street guys, first of all, you know, not even to mention that the fact they crashed our economy in 2007 and 2008, but, you know, whatever, they're making good money, hats off to them for making good money, but that money should be included as part of what's being fed into the Social Security system, not kept out and protected so they get to keep all of it. And also, you know, we want to keep that, get that cap off. It's only up to a certain mm-hmm. amount of income that of your Social Security that you pay that 6.2%. So we could just lift that cap too, right?
Absolutely, and we really need to do that. I mean, think about it this way: if you make $117,000 a year, you're paying 6.2% is your payroll tax rate. But if you make $1.1 million a year, if you make over $1 million a year, your Social Security, your payroll tax rate is 0.6%. So it makes no sense whatsoever for somebody making, you know, $1 million a year to pay just over a half a percentage in their rate when all the rest of us are paying 6.2%. That makes no sense. What we really have to do is a flat payroll tax for everybody on all of their earnings. Now, a flat tax, I think, I'm sure, I know you know, Eleanor, but I'm sure most of your listeners know, a flat tax is quite regressive. Flat taxes fall most heavily on the lower income earners than on the upper income earners because, you know, the yacht costs the same amount of money, whether you're making a little bit of money or a lot. The pair of shoes, they don't give you a discount because you're not making so much money. So the flat taxes are quite regressive. But Social Security was designed to have a regressive tax going in, a flat tax going into the system, and then steeply progressive benefits coming out. So there's a guaranteed minimum that you get in your Social Security payment every month. Even if you've worked all your life at a very low-income job, you get a guaranteed minimum. There are other adjustments made. There are, you know, for the first so many, on your average, when they go to figure out your average earnings for the past 35 years, you get, you know, 50% of your average earnings up to so many dollars, and then you get 30% of your average up to so many dollars. Yep. So you get less and less the wealthier you are, because the wealthier you are, you should have been saving something.
All right. So we've got a looming retirement crisis, but you've got the plan of action. Bring all the income into the Social Security system and increase the payouts for Social Security.
Yes.
And what we need to do is to elect members of Congress who recognize this and make that happen in Congress. Is that our plan?
That's the plan, and there's one other piece of the expansion of benefits that I think is really important, and it mostly affects women, but it's also for men as well.
That's all the time we have. Terry O'Neill, thank you so much for being with us today and for all your important work.
Thank you, Eleanor.